Let's do this again. Good afternoon. Welcome back. School's in process. The commission is meeting. We have a full agenda today. What I did want to do just to alert people is that CTN is in fact filming again today, and they've requested that we introduce ourselves, please, if we could. So, Ms. Grineman, may I ask you to start and tell us who you are and what your organization is, please?
I'm Judy Grineman. I run the Connecticut Conference of Independent
Christopher Brule with the Business Council of Fairfield County.
Ed Klonowski, Charter Oak State College.
Hedley Freak, the University of Connecticut.
Sally Reese, University of Connecticut.
Lois Schneider, Management Consultant.
Bagus Haji Michael, Fairfield University.
Jason Jakubowski, Hospital for Special Care.
Good afternoon, Dennis Murphy, Department of Labor.
Well, welcome all, and glad to have you, Dennis.
I'm State Senator, ranking member of the Higher Education Committee, the Education Committee, the Transportation Committee, and just a regular member of the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee.
In her spare time. I'm Judy Resnick, and I'm the Executive Director of CBI's Education Foundation.
Hi, I'm State Representative Roberta Willis, and I am the House Chair of the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee.
Hi, my name is State Senator Beth Bai from the 5th District.
So now we're back on and cooking with gas at this point. Could I ask for a motion to dispense with the minutes from last meeting?
So moved.
May I have a second? Yes. Can I have another second? Thank you very much, Bagos. All those in favor? Those opposed? Any abstentions? Then the motion carries. Thank you very much. We so noted two abstentions for people that, in fact, were not there. So we have some good news for you. It's always nice to be able to start a meeting off with good news. For those of you that remember this summer, we worked long and hard on both, and thanks to John Shimo and Representative Willis and those others that participated in writing the RFP, we issued an RFP for a consultant to guide our work here on the commission and convened a committee, a small committee, to review the proposals that we received. They were due on July 18th. The committee met shortly thereafter and reviewed the applications according to the criteria that were listed with the RFP and made a decision. And at that point, we turned it over to our colleagues, John Harding and Tina Moore, who were very ably our representatives in the contracting process. And, in fact, I am happy to report, as is Representative Wilson and Senator Bai, that we have a signed contract. And I am pleased to announce that our consultant that we have chosen is NCHEMS. How many people here have worked with NCHEMS before? One, two, three, which is awfully nice. I made some notes, which I, of course, have not. Now, I put them in the wrong place. NCHEMS is the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, fondly known as NCHEMS. I wanted to tell you, for those that have not worked with them, a bit about them, so I think you'll be very pleased when we meet with them. NCHEMS is a bit of a national leader in this work. They've done this in many, many states. And in fact, one of the things that we felt was a very strong indicator is that they're doing follow-on work in a number of states. And these states include North Dakota, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Colorado. And if you remember when Judy Grineman presented some of the work that's out there in other states in their strategic plans, many of those were in that group that we thought represented some really good work that might be useful to us here in Connecticut. They've also got expertise in working at the systems level in states with the University of Maine system, Mississippi, and Nevada. So they've worked both at the state level and they've worked at the systems level. They have accumulated over their many years of experience, and I think Dennis Jones, the president, has been there since 1969. They've accumulated a tremendous database of information. And I think that their access to this information will be very helpful to our work as we create this plan. And frankly, I think maybe a cost savings measure, that we will not have to recreate some of this data. They actually have it at their fingertips. And in fact, one of the other applicants actually cited their work in their application, so we thought that was a good indication. Lots of experience. Their plan was thoughtful and answered our questions. They've assigned three specific staff that will be working with us: Dennis Jones, who's the president of the organization, Dr. Patrick Kelly, the senior associate, and Dr. Ames McGinnis, also a senior associate. So we have their backgrounds of the individuals are quite robust. They have national reputations, and I think will serve us well. So we're thrilled. We hope you will be as well. In fact, I think you will be. I'll be a little more positive about that. And our hope, we will have conversations with them. They literally just signed the contract on Monday, so this is a bit of a catch-up. Our hope is we will talk with them tomorrow, and we would like very much to see if they can join us at the next commission meeting so that you get a chance to meet them. And I think we will be talking about the way in which we need to work together with them and with the commission and with the stakeholders that many of us have been talking about for the past month. So I thought I would lay that out for you. Thoughts, questions, comments?
I have a comment. I just want to say that I was very pleased with the selection. Both of the candidates before us put forth incredible proposals. All of us liked both of them. They had different strengths, but NCHAMPS is really, the gold standard, I think, on strategic planning in the United States. And many of the states that we've talked about that have really moved ahead, like Indiana and Tennessee, I mean, those are Oregon. NCHAMPS guided all of them in their strategic planning process. So, and again, the last presentation we had, I believe that Braden and Monica Chan gave from New England Board of Higher Education, they all cite NCHAMPS data, when they make their presentations. So unlike the other consultants that came before us, they would have to have done the research, and NCHAMPS has the research. So I think that's a tremendous advantage. So I thank everyone for their efforts. I thank the Office of Legislative Management, John and Tina. You were terrific. We could have clearly not done it without your technical assistance, because we had no clue. So thank you.
Agreed. So if there are no questions, let us turn to the meat of the meeting today, and that's something many of you have asked for, which is for a robust discussion on distance learning. And a lot of times we look out of state for experts, but we are blessed here in Connecticut with our own expert, who has been at this for how many years, Ed?
This, about 15.
Yeah. So I remember when the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium was actually born, so I guess maybe I shouldn't say that. It makes me too old. But in any case, we've asked Ed really to give us the lay of the land and really to level the playing field. I think not all of us are as technically adept and or as knowledgeable about distance learning. And if we are to look at ways in which this state can go forward, clearly we need to be looking at distance learning. And clearly Dr. Gray has made that a priority for his new administration as well, too. So what better person to do it? And Ed's title today is Planning for a Disrupted Industry, which I love. So let me turn the meeting over to the president of Charter Oak State College, Ed Klonowski.
Thank you, and I appreciate the invitation. So I'm going to say a few things, because you probably couldn't stop me from saying a few things, but I want to leave time for questions, and I'm open to interruptions. So if I go down a path you want me to stop, if I lie, you can just ask me the question you need to ask. I put my background on the screen for two reasons. One, I wasn't born a president of a college. I did some things along the way. Most of them are in this technology field. As Judy mentioned, I was the first employee for the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium. Judy was and still is on the board of the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium. And what we did about 15 years ago with lots of support from Connecticut Higher Ed and from the legislature was we birthed distance learning in Connecticut. At one point, we had 2 years where we had a $2 million fund of money to seed programs, and we did that. So Connecticut was a big supporter of distance learning 15 years ago when it was in its infancy and is a fairly robust participant in it now. So that's some context for who I am and where I've come from. You know I'm the president of Charter Oak State College. I'm also going to say a few things about competency-based learning along the way to try to set a context for what distance learning has done to change higher ed. So disruption was in my title, and most of you have probably read Clayton Christensen's work or you know of it. What he talks about is that established industries do not get disrupted by sustaining innovations. So things that make your products and services 3 and 5% better don't change the industry. What disrupts an industry is a cheap, shoddy, second-rate product that's of use to people who can't consume the mainstream product. A disruptive innovation serves underserved or non-served folks. So when we rolled out distance learning, Judy remembers this story because I tell it all the time, we were doing reviews of students. How were we doing? And this woman wrote to us, and I've never forgotten it. Took an online course from you guys, worst course I ever took. Signed up for two more next semester. So we had a ways to go to improve, and I believe we have. But more importantly, we knew we were tapping unmet demand. We were disrupting. This person was taking the online course because that was the only way she could get her higher education accomplished or the only way she could speed it up. So what we've learned from these sorts of disruptions, what distance education taught us, is that learning is an activity, not a location. And that's profound. Think about it. An activity, not a location. We've spent lots of resources across the country, across public and private higher ed, building resource centers in which education can occur. What distance learning did that was radical was say, that's all nice. It certainly can occur there, but it doesn't have to. And it doesn't. And I'll get some numbers I'll show you in a bit. That's a big deal, folks. That's a major disruption. Second thing I'll tell you is that if you wanted to do a study today comparing traditional on-ground education and online education, you wouldn't be able to find a control group for traditional online on-ground education. We've infiltrated the mothership. Everybody uses learning management systems. Everybody uses email. Everybody posts their syllabus online. Everybody accepts tests in a Dropbox. So while you don't hear it said this way much, in the struggle between traditional education and distance education won. We've changed the academy. It didn't go the other way around. So the other thing that's on the table here is competency-based learning. I know you've talked a little bit about the MOOCs. These are massive online courses. What's interesting about them isn't that they're new. What's interesting about them is that they're free. So what they represent is the disaggregation, the taking apart of assessment, the grade, the degree, and the instruction, and they're giving away the instruction. So if you thought telling higher ed that learning was an activity, not a location, was radical, try telling higher ed that the primary means by which it generates revenue, which is instruction, can be given away for free. So when I say we're existing in a disrupted industry, that's what I'm talking about. There's things happening that won't change us a little, that could completely change us. And distance learning is one of them. Competency-based learning is the other, the idea that instruction and assessment are separate. Now, in case you think this is brand new, Charter Oak's been doing assessment without instruction for most of its history. When we were invented by you 40 years ago, we had no courses. What we had was a set of degree requirements that you could meet by using other people's courses or portfolios or tests. So we were sort of one of the original competency-based institutions. You'd get a 120-credit degree from us. We didn't offer any courses. We did no instruction. Just to anchor you there a little bit. And the third thing that's driving this conversation is the ROI on higher ed is being reconsidered. And as you can see from the bottom of my slide, it's being reconsidered by lots of different folks. But my favorite story is about families. Many of you have college-age children. So you've shooed them out of the house. Jason, you're going to do this in about 10 years. You and your wife are going to sit at the kitchen table, and you're going to say, child number one, she's sweet, she's smart, she works hard, and she wants to major in a STEM field. We're going to bankrupt ourselves to educate her. Child number two, he's lovely. Everybody likes him. A little bit of a slacker. Not sure what he wants to be or major in. He's not going to a $50,000 institution. He's going to a much less expensive institution. when I tell that story everywhere I go, everyone raises their hand and goes, those are my kids. Because they are. That ROI discussion isn't making the mainstream media, but it's having enormous impact on how much money people are willing to spend and borrow to put their children through college. They're still willing to do large-scale funding for their children, but only if their children's ROI looks promising. It's hard to talk about that in public. It's hard to have your children hear you say that about them, but it's true. And so that's driving as well as employers and business in Washington. So we're under real pressure as an industry from multiple directions. We have to improve students' learning progress in real time. So if you're an online course, we know what you're doing on a sort of minute-by-minute basis. So we've been struggling to find ways to intervene with students who are having learning problems before they know they are. So we have, and there's lots of software that does this, but we monitor students. So if somebody hasn't done an assignment and it's 48 hours late, they get a phone call. What's up? I mean, it's the same thing your credit card companies can do to you, if, as I did. I bought jewelry. I do that so rarely that before I left the mall, I had an email, a text message, and a phone call wondering if that was really me. That was embarrassing. But it was a demonstration of what they can do with technology if they're paying attention. We're trying to do that. We're trying to help students before they know they have a problem, when they can still solve that problem. So that's one pressure. Second pressure, we have to measure learning outcomes because as an industry, we've resisted that. And that's what the competency-based stuff, the MOOCs, is really all about. The thing higher ed owns is outcomes. But we can't say they're B's. We can't say they follow the degree path. We have to measure those outcomes in ways that make sense to the non-higher ed universe. And the third piece of that is you've heard about gainful employment. And while I think that particular law was badly constructed, I think the pressure to measure the effects of a higher ed degree long-term aren't going away. We're going to be asked, we're going to be required to make a connection between a credential and a career path. And we're going to be asked to do that numerically. So those are the drivers for a lot of the conversations that we're having in a lot of the states. So when NCHEM comes here, and they're cool, I've been in their place in Boulder, they're going to talk to you about that. All right, distance learning. What is it? Well, as I'm using the term, it's asynchronous distance learning, which means it's not a video that everybody's watching at the same time. It's learning that's occurring across a chunk of time, but not at a particular moment in that chunk. So the way we do it at Charter Oak is courses can be 8 weeks long or they can be 15 weeks long. They have a week's worth of material that students must do. They can do that work any time in that week. So their travel or their work schedule or their children's illnesses don't affect their ability to participate. But that work consists of lots of collaborative activity. So there are no Charter Oak courses that are independent studies. The idea is you want to have 10 to 30 students in a class. You want to give them lots of opportunities to interact. You want to give the person instructing the class lots of opportunities to mentor and guide students. So they're cohort-based. They're outcomes-focused. Since you can't do what I'm doing now particularly, I mean, you can record a lecture and you can put it in the course, but what do you do when you're watching lectures on your computer? Come on, fess up. You multitask. I'm trying to be cute, but this is not that compelling a learning strategy. We did this. We did lectures for 2,000 years because it was the best technology we had. We put everybody in the same room and somebody smart talked at them. But we've always known that auditory learning styles are rare. In fact, the community that has the largest percentage of auditory learners is what? The faculty. We got where we got because we were good at learning from people who talked at us. Most people aren't very good at that. So anyway, we've got courses that are not having people talk at you. Instead, we have students do things. So, for example, you're teaching a course on K-12 education. You have folks go to a Board of Education meeting, and they report back on what they saw, heard, and felt about that meeting. And then they talk about what happened at the various Board of Ed meetings, and they come to some conclusion about how the state they're in, Connecticut or wherever, manages K-12 education. And that's more powerful and more effective than just reading about it or hearing about it. They do those things after they've seen it. So when I say it's what do you know and what can you do, we have to find ways to measure students' learning that's different than just a multiple choice test. So the struggle in distance learning is if you're going to take out this conversation, then you have to give students a way to demonstrate what they've learned that's universal. That's how you get out of the log jam of who took the class and who was there. You make the whole class process-based. So along the way, students do things, they redo things, they share things, they give other people advice, they hand in assignments before they're finished, bring them back, make them better. So the whole process is like work. And if you look at the bottom of my screen, I think the thing about a distance learning classroom that's most remarkable is it comes the closest to imitating a 21st century workplace. If you think about your own jobs, you use a computer, you use a phone, you use text, you use email, you work with people who are not in the building with you, you're on teams that are not local for you, you do projects in which you're the lead agent and other projects in which you're not. That's exactly how a distance learning class operates, just like the 21st century workplace, using the same tools that these students will use when they're out in the workplace. Questions about any of that? Anybody still unclear about what I mean when I say distance learning? Okay, here's the numbers. Yes, Senator.
Just a quick question, and maybe you're going to get to it, which just say I'm going to get to it, but I think we're thinking as of, at least the way I'm thinking of it in my mind so far, is of distance learning as a thing versus a continuum. I mean, you talked about the email and you know, parts of classes are now distance learning. But I'm hearing more and more about blended models and things like that. So would you say distance learning is more of a continuum or more of a thing?
Well, I mean, the federal government has a definition. We were part of the demonstration program that allowed financial aid to be used for pure distance plays. So something like 80%, if I remember the number right, has to be online for it to be a real, a purely distance-delivered course. Now, I didn't talk a lot about threaded discussions, but that's the tool that was always at the heart of what we did to create interactivity, and that tool is being used in on-ground classes. Because this discussion we're having now is something I call a monologue. I talk, so the senator asks a question, I get to talk again. Representative Willis has a question, and I'm going to get to talk again. It's not really very fair. I mean, I'm the one who knows the most about distance learning, and I'm doing all the talking. How are you supposed to learn anything? So in a threaded discussion, I don't talk. The teacher doesn't talk. The students talk. They talk about the topic that's been posted. They talk about each other's posts, right, Jason? And your job is, because Jason does online instruction, his job is to make sure that the conversation's appropriate. He jumps in every once in a while to give encouragement. But he's not the one talking in the discussion. The students are. So when you ask me if distance learning is on a continuum, the answer is clearly yes. And if you ask me where the bang for the buck is, it is in hybrid classes. To my way of thinking, that's the place where we're taking the best from face-to-face instruction and the best from online instruction and putting them together to do the most pedagogical good for students. The difference between a hybrid and online, though, is all about geography. So at the end of the day, with adults, the problem that they have is they can't be in place A at time B. They can't. Not on any regular basis. You can't, I can't, none of us can. Because employment has shifted. I mean, who clocks out at 5 o'clock anymore? And knows that at 5:30 they can drive across whatever town they're in and get to the school they need to be to show up in class. Nobody. So the pure distance play is about time and space. The hybrid is about taking the best strategies from both worlds and applying them. So, Roberta, did you have a question? Did I see your hand up? No? Okay. We move on. Numbers. If you look in the bottom right-hand corner, in fact, if you look at the right-hand column, you'll see the growth rates from one of the two articles I sent you about distance learning participation in higher ed. Right now, as in 2011, 32% of higher ed students have distance learning credits on their transcript. I sent you a one-pager that suggests that in the time since then, it's hit 45%. If you look at the next slide, all you've got to do is look at the curve on the line. Now, this is pure distance learning, by the way. This is not hybrid. If we put hybrid on the chart, there wouldn't be anything else on the chart. It would all be red. It's very difficult to take a 21st century college age student or an adult age college student and say to them, I'm going to teach a class, but I'm not going to give you my email address. Who does that? I mean, college professors are public figures. They have to be available. So, yes, they have office hours if they're there in person, but it's not conceivable in the 21st century with students that are bringing multiple devices to class and texting and emailing and looking up stuff on Google while you talk, that you won't hand out your email address, that you won't respond to email questions. So the ship has simply sailed. Everything has distance learning components in it now. That's what this represents. Now, the interesting piece is this next slide.
Ed, I have a question.
Yep.
This is U.S. numbers total.
Yes.
Or is this Connecticut? This is U.S.
Correct.
Okay. If we looked at a slide, a chart on Connecticut, would it be different?
My guess is not dramatically different.
Okay.
Do you know? What's the same in Connecticut as the curve? The percentage of penetration, because what I want to talk about on this next slide is this. Who are you imagining, Roberta, when you imagine Connecticut students? Because if you're imagining 18 to 24-year-old residential full-time college students, you're only imagining 15% of the marketplace. Now, what I can tell you is that in Connecticut, the number's higher. The number of residential full-time traditional college-age students is higher than 15%. But nationally, it's 15%. The number that should blow your mind is that students who are older than 24 represent somewhere around 65% of the market. So the traditional college student is us. It's grown-ups going to school part-time. And even if you just say, well, I want 18 to 24-year-olds, whether they're full-time, part-time, residential or not, you're still only at 35%.
Well, after listening to Braden Hodge present last time on the numbers, basically the population that we need to go after is the non-traditional, not the student right after. The growth in terms of trying to combat declining enrollment is looking at the 25 to 45-year-old
right.
students.
That's what Lumina's been saying. They did the arithmetic. We need a million more degrees from that population every year if we're going to get to their 60% number. We only made so many 17-year-olds. And we can't make any more of them. It takes 17 years to produce one. So they are what they are. We have as many as we have. We should do everything we can to make sure each one of them is post-secondary education ready, and that when they go into the post-secondary system, that they stick. Absolute believer in that. But the numbers are in a different place. The thing that should disturb everybody is that a couple of days ago, we saw the total higher ed population, and it's not 21 million students, which I have on some slide somewhere. It dropped by 500,000 students, and the drop was biggest among adult students. The spin that folks are putting on it, and I hope they're right, is that represents the employment market improving. That folks, traditionally, adults went to college when the economy was lousy. They used whatever extra time or money they had to get more skills and more education to re-enter the economy. But the economy has been bad since 2008. No one's really sure. And higher ed's numbers have been going up since 2008, but nobody's really sure when that would stop. I mean, the feds have put, I think it's $35 billion a year into Pell money, and they've actually increased that. I mean, they took it to a place it's never been, and then they went even higher. So it's hard to know what will happen when and if the Pell money shifts, when and if the job market improves. But my thinking is that the job market, when it finally comes back, is not going to return all the same jobs that it once had. There are going to be new jobs that require new skills. So if I had to make a bet, and I guess I'd bet my career, I think what adults are going to continue to need is credentialing, skills, education. It just may not be the skills and education for jobs that we're familiar with. It may be skills and education for jobs we're not familiar with. Charter Oak just launched health information management because we think, the research showed us when we hired a consultant to do it, that information technology jobs in the health professions are going to grow for the next decade as they try to do patient records so that you can have them on a flash drive so that they can handle the security issues. Our next program is going to be data security, because if they're going to put your data on a flash drive, you have to be sure no one else has it. Only the appropriate people have it. So, I mean, we're trying to build programs as best we can that fill those niches that we think are going to be employment rich. So degrees matter, but particular degrees matter more. So you try to match yourself up to where the work is going to be. Yes, sir.
I'm trying to get a sense of the size of this increase, because the way it's expressed is students taking at least one online course.
Correct.
So how many courses are they actually taking? So of the 120 credit of a bachelor's degree, have you got a figure of the average percentage would be?
If you are planning to get your degree online, then you would go to an online institution. In those institutions, all the credits are online. And there's lots of them. Private, public, for-profit, not-for-profit. What this is showing is that online education is happening at institutions that are primarily not online. So students are in dormitories with robust networks, and they're pursuing their education using online courses from their home institution or from others that they transfer in. I mean, the slide, what I'm trying to talk about here is, in this slide, if you look at the second bullet down here, students are shopping for their degree, which means, and I You're good. You weren't there, but I was talking at Quinnipiac University about 15 years ago, and the president was in the front, one of the smartest guys in Connecticut. And I said, there's a lovely campus, and he beamed. And I said, but my daughter's not going to make her first impression of Quinnipiac from your campus. She's going to have her first impression of Quinnipiac from your website. He had a committee to improve the website the next day. Students are in his dormitories taking courses from community colleges. We wanted to shut the network down. I mean, this is all news to people. We thought, you know, you captured a student when you enrolled them, right? Has anyone captured you as a shopper? No, you shop wherever you need to shop. You get the prices you need to get to buy. You buy from Amazon. I mean, we have this bookstore that online. People, our students all go to Amazon. They go to eBay. They don't care what our bookstore is. They shop for the best price, and that's what they buy. So they do the same thing courseware-wise. Now, we have rules in higher ed that make transfer difficult, but not impossible. And there's not an institution in the state that would take a eighth-semester senior and say, we're not going to graduate you because your last three credits didn't come from us, even though the rules say they have to. I mean, we're not dumb. So what's happening is we're trying to adjust to this new consumer, and it's really difficult. It's really challenging. So nobody cares whether they take six credits or 60 credits. The interesting piece is that they're willing to take credits online. They don't see any difference between those in a lecture class or a small class or an independent study. And for adults, that ship sailed a long time ago. They weren't coming to college at all before they could find a way to get their education that met their lifestyle needs.
This is such an interesting topic. I think we're all thinking really hard about this. For me, one of the challenges when you talk about they're going to shop is that some of the bad actors are very good at marketing.
They're better than us.
They're better.
Very, very well.
And how does... So we're here because we're talking about a public system with the Board of Regents, with Charter Oak. How do we compete? How do we...
You're never going to market better than people who market as their only core expertise. However, we have one advantage. As a public system or as a state entity, we're serious. We have time and reputation. I mean, UConn just got ranked 19th. Congratulations. That's amazing. You know, we've got independent colleges that are at the absolute top of the food chain. Yale, Wesleyan, Trinity, the list goes on and on. And we have schools in other niches that do really interesting things for really interesting students. So our problem is not a marketing problem. Our problem is a responsiveness problem. Do we have the right programs for the right career paths? So when St. Joe's launched its EBD in pharmacy, they found the right program. And they made it work. They worked hard to make it work, and it is working. So it isn't marketing center. We will not market better than Amazon. They have $250 million a year that they spend on internet marketing. Charter Oak has $250,000 a year that it spends on marketing. We can't compete on a marketing basis. We just can't.
But I mean, I guess just to push back a little bit when you talk about the degrees you need, certainly my impression that there are colleges... less scrupulous, marketing to students for jobs that don't exist.
Correct.
Because it sounds good, because it sounds like it's a medical job, and there are no jobs. So I think not to treat the consumer as not thoughtful, but I think there are big perceptions out there about the kinds of STEM jobs, if you will, that make some students particularly vulnerable to marketing for programs that are not going to lead to a job. And how do we...
We need to talk about what we do in that arena that we do well. So, I mean, I'm going to use UConn as an example again. They're focused on STEM jobs. That's what the governor's support for them is going to produce. And they're focused like a laser beam on that. And they know at the end of the day they have to measure job increases in that arena. Not degree attainment, job attainment. So in the Board of Regents, we have almost 100,000 students. We're part of a supply chain to employers. But we never measure it. We never talk about it. We never make deals with the employer committee. I'm sitting next to Chris. He's heard me do this before. What I want to create is a relationship between what we are, the supply side of employment, and the employers, who are the demand side. But I want to create a real deal. So if I produce 7 students in field X with skills A and B, because Chris needs them, he agrees to interview them when I graduate them. So if I can send a student to Chris's business with a portfolio that demonstrates both the hard and soft skills his industry requires, he has an obligation to interview that student. In other words, we have a supply chain relationship. We write contracts between us. I mean, what higher ed does is produce talent that business consumes, but we have no relationship. There's no deal there. There should be. There must be. And that's what a public sector set of institutions can do. I think, in effect, that's what UConn's doing.
Okay. I appreciate that. And I'll just close with, you know, I think as we think about our strategic plan, we do need to think through this. Marketing's not the right word, but, you know, building a niche that students understand for our collection of state institutions that are there to be responsive to the job needs of Connecticut, because I see a serious siphoning off of students to programs from which they're never going to graduate, and if they do, they're not going to get a job by people who see the student loan and Pell dollars. And so I think it's a very serious consideration for this committee.
I couldn't agree more.
So you're giving some great pragmatic suggestions about how we can deal with that. But for me, as chair of higher ed, it's one of my biggest concerns.
We have one other question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, too, but that's something we must put on the agenda for all of it. Yeah.
Senator Boucher, I got
yes.
that wrong before. I'm
yes,
sorry.
Sir. This is a topic that is just so important, and I've been grappling with it myself and reading a great deal about it. There's so many implications, and it sort of reminds me of when Howard Johnson's, where I worked as a soda fountain girl years ago, my first job, just got taken under by a brand new paradigm shift in McDonald's. And here they had the location, right? They had the places all over the country to transform themselves into a marketplace that wanted fast, instant, you know, drive-through food as quickly as possible. And they didn't get it. And as a result, they got taken under. Now, we have this distance learning phenomenon, the MOOCs phenomenon, that could feel a bit of a threat to the current established environment that we have. We have infrastructure, but I would say you turn that into your positive. That's where you have a leg up on the new distance learning totally online. You actually have a location that has a reputation, and it's a matter of how do you change the way that that current established institution provides that education outward, and whether or not a degree or a certificate or a competency is what is required out there. And maybe it could be each of those things, and how they deliver the content could be different. And it could be removing a lot of those barriers that you're talking about that you have there, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it could be for various types of needs and desires on the part of the public. There still is a place for the traditional degree, you know, my 57 hours for that MBA, you know, only one of those courses was a full online course, and it was a revelation to me of how hard I had to actually work there and the hours that they followed me that I was tracking online. But yet, there was one or two meetings where we were in person, so you could connect again. And that was an interesting lesson for me. But the idea of accessing tremendous instruction, and anyone could get to it at a fee that is little or nothing. So how do you be able to continue to exist as an institution with the high costs that you have
you
of infrastructure? Or do you then make the degree the ticket to your fee, and you allow the instruction to be free, but if you want that certificate, then you have to pay a certain dollar amount for that. That's what I'm grappling with here.
Well, the MOOCs are the wrong place to start the conversation, because they don't have a business model yet, but they'll invent one. Schools are already using them as publishers, and they're marrying their content to courses. The more important observation I want to make, and it's on this slide, is that I told you students are consumers. What that slide about distance learning growth showed you was not higher ed creating a market. It was about the market creating a market. You can't write a plan and say to students, we've built it, now come. They've already decided how they want to come. And that's it. The market is deciding, not us. In any other industry, the way things happen, you build products and services, and people buy them or they don't. If you market well, maybe they'll buy for a little longer. But at the end of the day, if you don't meet a need in a way that makes sense to them, they buy someone else's product. I'm telling you that that's what this means. Not that higher ed embraced distance learning. It did to some extent. Consumers embraced it. And so if consumers embrace competency-based learning, or if they embrace multiple institutional approaches to a degree, which they're already doing, if the consumer expects mass customization from us, which they've expected from every other industry that's been disrupted by technology, then Connecticut's plan has to give students a way to do that. And it isn't as complicated as some words like mass customization sounds. You did the first thing in the Board of Regents when you made transfer easier. We may need to make it even easier. I'm having a conversation with Naugatuck Valley now about reverse transfer. The University of Hartford does this now with the University of St. Joseph. So a senior biology major from the University of Hartford can go into the pharmacy program at St. Joe's, and what comes back is they get finished their degree at the University of Hartford even though they're taking courses at St. Joseph's. I want to do the same thing with Naugatuck Valley at the associate bachelor's level. That happens all over the country. We need to loosen up our approach so that students can get what they want in ways that make a sense, quality sense, but that allow for more flexibility than the typical institutional model provides. If we can figure that out. So if you can use Charter Oak's distance learning capacity and the science labs at the CSUs and the point of presence at the community colleges, if you can take all of that power and harness it in a way that makes sense to the consumer, then you've got a winner. What you cannot do, what will not work, is to say, here's what we've got. We think it's great. Buy it. Because that's not the marketplace we're in. A couple of thoughts on this idea.
Interrupt you just for a minute, because I have to leave now for another meeting and I have to drive an hour to get there. But I just, because I'm so excited about this area and what you're discussing is so important. I am so glad I got to hear the bulk of what you had to say. But I think that our institutions of higher learning all have a great reputation in Connecticut. People want to go there because they know of them. They have a good reputation. So how do we actually utilize that, you know, and take advantage of that so that you can then deliver this new way of teaching and learning and online instruction, so it's coming from them and not from an institution that Senator Beth Bayh was talking about that is really, really out there just to get somebody's money as quickly as they can, whether they succeed or not or get content or not. That's our at least we have a sense of trust that our institutions are going to deliver on content and at least give good instruction to individuals so that they're not wasting their money spending it unnecessarily. So I'm wondering if there's a way that you can piggyback on that great reputation and be able to deliver. And the key is, how do our current institutions open up their minds and start to really embrace all of this? Because as you said, it's coming whether they want it or not.
We could talk about incentives maybe on another day.
Yeah, I would be happy to share what we've decided to do at UConn as our strategy, which I think will really connect very well with what the rest of the system is doing. We are going to highlight the mostly post-baccalaureate, so we're not going to be competing with at the bachelor degree level, but we're going to highlight the work of our very best professors, primarily in areas of high need in terms of employment and also of interest throughout the state, but primarily in post-baccalaureate certificates, so 9-credit, 12-credit, 15-credit certificates. And we believe by highlighting the best work of our professors, we don't have to worry as much about reputation. People are already coming to us for those reasons. We're going to be doing one, Senator Bynos, on early childhood disabilities. We're going to get involved more in post-secondary disabilities. So areas we already do outstanding research in, and that's going to be our marketing. We're going to stick to that, not the undergraduate population. And we anxiously await an opportunity to work with everybody on kind of sharing that strategy. So that's just from UConn's point of view.
So one of the things you do in a down market is that you rediscover your niche and make sure you're the best there is at the thing you do. And that's what I'm hearing UConn doing. That's what Charter Oak wants to be and do. This is the wrong time to be comprehensive. It's the wrong time to try to get bigger and wider. It's the time to stay deep and narrow. Now, in order to make all that work, you need partnerships. So, you know, UConn's going to do its thing. And we'll do our thing. Your plan needs to knit all that together. So for the student, it's all seamless. Transfer should be easier. You should be able to, and I'm fighting with Washington about this, for example. If you have Title IV financial aid, you can use it to take a course. But you can't use it to take a test or a portfolio, even though they're cheaper than a course. So we're going to change that so that the student's choices aren't driven by the financial aid regulations. They're really driven by the way students learn and what will work best for them. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that we need to talk about. I think I'm going to stop talking and see if there's more questions.
Quick question, Ed. Oh, there's a question over there.
Just a very general question. I mean, you're the apostle of online delivery of courses. I understand that, and I've done some of this in my institution, so we've got some experience. My question to you is, do you see a downside to this model? I mean, we've heard about the upside and what it does, et cetera.
There's things you can't do. I mean, you can't teach wet sciences online. It's really hard. You can do a little of it, but not a lot of it. So I mean, if you've got complicated equipment that students need to touch to learn something, it's very hard to do that online. You can't teach master apprentice courses online. So if you want to learn to dance better, you have to be in the presence of the master. If you want to learn to play your instrument better, it's helpful to be around other people who are playing in real time. Those are harder things to do. But, and you don't want to hear this, but simulation-based learning is going to get enormous, and it's going to get enormous very fast. There's dot-comers on the West Coast who are building adaptable learning engines. That's what they call them. And the idea is that Ed goes into the system, and he takes tests until he gets stuck in whatever subject area he's in, and then the instruction starts, not with an instructor, but with a series of prompts and quizzes and tests that adapt to my learning style. So if I like to listen, it gives me lectures. If I like to see diagrams, it gives me diagrams. And you know what these guys are going to do first? They're going to teach English first. Why? Because they don't want to serve the American student audience. They want to serve the third world audience, because that's the underserved, unserved audience that they're all reaching for. It's China that needs more degrees. It's Pakistan and Afghanistan and India. And so when I say that the world is going to be disrupted, you have to be careful not to take a narrow geographical view of this. Our economies are not separated anymore in any real sense. So Connecticut exists geographically but not economically. The U.S. exists geographically but not economically. All those things are linked. So if I can create a learning adaptable engine, if I'm this dot-com genius and I can figure that out, I can sell it, $50 a credit or whatever, all over the globe. Here's what they can't do. They can't give a degree using an engine like that. So the conversation that they want to have with us in the Board of Regents is we want to give out state university degrees at the end of this cycle. But we're going to do 90 credits in the engine. You can do the last 30 credits in residence, and that's the deal. So when I say we have to find ways to partner and be flexible, those are the deals that are going to come to higher ed. And we can pass or we can accept, but that's the deal that they're looking for. And they'll lower the cost of instruction because the first 90 credits will cost almost nothing. Now, so what I'm trying to tell you, because this is the world that I live in, is that we have to have a plan for the state that takes into account the very, very volatile age in which we live. Higher ed has already changed dramatically in the last decade. It's going to change more as it becomes more international, more technical, more driven by consumer demand. Think of your phone company. You remember what that was like when we were all kids? Does it look like that now? Well, you get more, too. I'm not a shill for the phone company, but what the phone company did when it disaggregated all its services and let you buy everything independently is confuse us. So now they sell us packages. Packages sound a lot like degree programs to me. But the package is going to have to take learning modality into account. So I come in Charter Oak's front door and I say, I want to take that course on ground at Central. I want to take that one online. I want to do a portfolio for that one. I want to take a test for that one. Make it so. Oh, and by the way, I'm Title IV eligible, so I want to use my financial aid for all of that. That's the student I see every day. I think that student, because they're 65% of the market, I think that's who we need to write a plan for.
Can I ask a question? Or are we out of time? Thanks. So, Ed, I'm coming to a question of an implication. I want to hear whether you think that's true. If what we're saying is that one of the challenges that's coming is the documentation of the learning, i.e. a degree of some kind, certification. So it's an important part of the process is to determine, has it really been learned? Is a student truly proficient? So we have that as a challenge, which current many of these free MOOCs, et cetera, don't deliver on that side. As that is solved, we have the phenomenon that education is an experience, a process. It's not a place. But we have billions of dollars invested in places. I'm just thinking about Connecticut. And we have thousands, probably tens of thousands of people invested in living and working in these places. And if this technology is producing a shift towards it's what the student learns, as opposed to the traditionally defined place on where that student learns and who they learn it from and with, if that's the challenge, then much of this plan probably needs to assume that the places of higher education in Connecticut will have a continuously declining share of the students and therefore cannot be allowed to consume the lion's share of the resources. Because if we are worried about repairing roofs and paving parking lots while students don't need roofs and parking lots, then we are misallocating money, calling it education when it's actually a public works program. So I don't think that is the world of today, but Ed, am I right in thinking that's the world of the day after tomorrow?
Now I have to be real careful because I exist in a political environment. Do I think place-based higher education is going away in my lifetime? No. Do I think it will be smaller in my lifetime? Yes. I think it's smaller today. I mean, I think that decline in 17-year-olds is having an influence on the residential population as we speak. So the point Chris made, I'll agree with to this extent. If we don't invest in the future and only invest in what we've done in the past, then we won't prepare for that future. But I got to warn you, the future is moving so rapidly, it's hard to know. So that you have to have some principles in mind. And what little bit I know about that, I got from looking at the other industries that have been disrupted. What happens in a disrupted industry is that consumers get more choices, and they make them. We have to have a plan that allows us to maintain our quality while we support those choices. The danger is in saying, we know what's good for you, consumer, and here, we're giving it to you. It's a copper-based phone system. It hangs on the wall in your kitchen, and it rings whenever it wants. And people just decided, you know what, I don't really want that. So I still have the copper in my kitchen, but I don't want that. I don't answer that phone. You following me? So it's not simple, and it's not going to happen tomorrow. But if we're talking about a plan for higher ed, then you have to embrace that reality, that we are going to be driven by our customers, not by our infrastructure. Remember, the people who are going to disrupt higher education are not in it. I'm talking about those dot-comers for a reason. All of those of us who are in higher ed and love it, we're not going to be the ones that change it that way. It's going to be outsiders that do it. So you're an employer. Two people come to you for a job. One's got a degree from Institution X. Great degree, great reputation, great degree. The other student has a credential from one of these online things. But he also has a portfolio. And in it, he can prove that he can do the things your job requires. The other student has a degree. Who are you going to hire? You're going to hire the person with the proven track record. So at the very least, that's why I talked about outcomes, we've got to prepare ourselves for that competition, where the credential, which is the king today, has to have demonstrations to it. It has to have provable skill sets attached to it. Portfolios would be one way to talk about it. Because at the end of the day, employers would probably hire the student from, I'll pick Princeton now because I don't want to hurt anybody, over the student from nowhere. But if you've got two folks in the room and one can show you that she can do the job, you're going to hire the one who can do the job. That's the reality we need to prepare for.
Hedley, I know you had a question.
Yes, I did. And I just want to make a little plea for the place. I have to leave now, actually, because I'm going to teach a class. I have to go back to the place. And the class that I'm going to teach is for a living learning community. So I'm the faculty advisor for the Global House Living Learning Community at UConn. And what I'm thinking about is the learning that happens outside of the courses, that happens when you aggregate a group of students together and you stick them down in one place. And sure, it's expensive and many people can't access it and we have to deal with those issues. But, you know, Global House has 130 students in it, half of them from the U.S., half of them from abroad. And they get to live together and they get to interact with each other and they get to learn from each other in the way that you do when you share the same bathroom rather than the same internet service. So absolutely, the points that you're making are very important, but I'm going to go teach my class.
Thank you, Judy.
I just want to make a couple comments about the place issue, and I think that it's important that we know that it's not black and white. So as Ed said, a lot of that arrow that we saw going up comes from students who are in their dorm rooms taking classes online, filling it. So you can't, that is not a student who's made the choice to leave the place. It's a student who's made the choice to fill in a different way. You know, some of the tools, I think as Ed very rightly said, the online world has invaded the on-ground in many of the tools. And so portfolios, which, you know, Connecticut has actually been a leader in developing portfolios, of the Distance Learning Consortium and Charter Oak, portfolios are used in many on-ground classes now. So you're not just having a student walking out, I've got the degree, I was the on-ground, and I've got the nifty portfolio, I was the online. Students in on-ground degrees have, many of them have portfolios. You know, which I think that there's, I think it's just neat, we need to recognize both. I mean, I think of the libraries that I walk into now versus the libraries that I walked into 15 years ago. So 15 years ago, I walk into, you know, libraries on the campuses, and, you know, it was the library that we all can think of. It was quiet in that first floor, and you had to go through your security, and there were steps. Now, most libraries on most campuses, that first floor, they're vibrant coffee shops with workspaces for groups and workspaces for individuals and comfy chairs because, yeah, a lot of the library resources are online, and so they're finding, colleges are finding ways to enhance the student experience within the context of the on-ground. So I just would say I think that every institution is seeing some of that increase, and it's, I think, probably a good thing for so many reasons. And some of that good stuff is coming to the on-ground. So we just, you know, it's not, the on-ground isn't going to go away. Certainly the demographics are going to play a role in what happens and shrinkage, but there's room for both.
Just kind of an observation, not a handing a softball to Ed here, but if somewhere between in Connecticut 15 and 20% of our students are in the 18 to 24 residential category, and it's a democracy we're using public money, at least 80% of the public is not participating in that form of the students in that form of education. It doesn't in any way reduce the validity of that education to observe that we have underserved people. And the allocation of resources across instructional needs, i.e. we need faculty a whole lot more than we need buildings, right? And we need access to faculty and knowledgeable faculty and faculty as coaches and mentors a whole lot more than we need certain other things. All those are absolutely true, but it doesn't change the fact that demographically the question's already been answered. The vast majority of students are over the age of 24. The vast majority of students can't go live on the campus, and the vast majority of students cannot drive 45 minutes to a campus to get to. So we can, therefore, it doesn't mean that the expansion of our planning process to consider the needs of those other students in any way dismisses or diminishes the reality of those students who are being served in the current system. And I think we want to be careful that in our effort to protect the quality that we have in the current system, we don't inadvertently continue to maintain limited access for the very large majority of people. Because Connecticut's long-term viability is determined by, can we raise the attainment level among those who are not now attaining, not can we continue to generate the college degrees from the two-degree families. So over time, we don't want to throw out what we have, but we can't use the preservation of what we have as a inadvertent barrier to addressing these very profound needs. And distance learning does seem to be a way, because we do know that the vibrant, real, on-ground institutions are adapting because the students want it. They're not adapting because somehow it's a new model. They're adapting because the students want it. These other folks who should be students and who aren't need to be served. So I think that's the plan, not throwing out what we have, but charting a course towards a more balanced future is going to be necessary.
Thanks. Ed, you asked the question, posed the question a while back about the challenges to online learning.
It wasn't challenges to online learning, it's challenges to higher education.
Okay. Well, one of the articles that you gave us, that one pager, talked about the problems with online learning was that there are students that struggle with managing their time.
Mm-hmm.
And that when they don't have regular assignments and time schedules, they fall behind.
That's true.
Because they don't have those management skills. I mean, that is a basic thing that students need to learn first is those skills in order to succeed. So my question is, how does online learning address those challenges?
Well, I told you that we use a cohort-based model. So we built structure into each week of the course. So you have things that are due. You have to take, for example, two graded assignments so that we can keep track of attendance so we can satisfy Washington's financial aid regulations. I mean, it's the same thing that you would do in an on-ground campus with 17-year-olds. They arrive on campus, you orient them. You give them some information about time management, homework management, class schedules, maps of the campus. We do all the same things online. Most of our audience online, in Charter Oak's case, is adults. I didn't talk to you about what's happening in online education in the adolescent community, but it's growing there as well. We have all the same obligations to teach time management, study management, learning management online that you would have on ground. It's the same exact set of problems. Now, an online course requires a little greater motivation than an on-ground class might. But if you ask those people who run residential campuses which part of their student body they work the hardest to retain, it's first semester freshmen. It's the same set of issues. And if they can keep their first semester freshmen moving forward and coming back second semester, they can be confident they'll graduate. That's the area. It's the same with us. So you take your first couple of courses. If you don't manage your time and manage the course and manage your work well, we are going to lose you. So I talked about the technologies we use to intervene. We know when someone's opted out, and we call them up. What's going on? They get a little annoyed. How did you know? Our faculty didn't realize the same technology was letting us watch them, too. So it solved that. We didn't mean to solve that problem, but we did. Yep.
I had another question, which I have forgotten, so I will pass this.
You know where I live. You know where I live, Roberta.
I just love the questions and responses, and I think this conversation is just got all of our minds going. So I have a couple of observations, and I guess I want your response. I mean, Christopher, I think your question about how are we spending the money based compared to where the students are, where the degrees are coming from, I think that's a kind of analysis that we can ask for, you know, from our Office of Fiscal Analysis. And as we do our work, I think that's a really important consideration because, let's face it, we need the degrees. This isn't like hypothetical. One of our biggest problems in the state is we depend on an educated workforce. And we have a smaller population coming through, so it's not hypothetical. It's something that's critical. So I think if people on this committee have ideas about how to ask that question or think through that question so we can ask it in a way of the Office Fiscal Analysis, I think that would be great. The other thing, I think, Ed, that you talked about that I think we need to think about as a state and maybe as we move forward is look at our higher ed economy, our private institutions, our public institutions. They're huge employers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the money supporting those institutions is coming from out of state. Now, granted, we're sending students out of state, but I would argue that we're keeping more in state than we used to. At least I have three in college right now, so I've been through the process very recently.
Nice to see you can still afford clothes.
Yes, I've exported them all. But anyway, what I was going to say was I think it might make sense to try to stay ahead of things and think, when you talked about what's going on internationally, you know, just think about if Charter Oak State College could partner with private and public colleges and come up with a curriculum where students overseas could take online courses throughout the year and then come live in the dorms at all these campuses over the summer when they're opening, and we are the place they come and spend their money and get their degrees and get to know Connecticut, so maybe we import, if you will, some of those students.
Imagine that you're a business and your customers live in your building for 4 years, for 2 years, for 1 year. What business wouldn't want that opportunity? Well, we do that. We routinely have our customers live in our buildings. We own them
exactly.
For 4 years or 2 years or 1 year. I'll take that bet. I think if I brought students in for a final year at Eastern or at Southern or at Quinnipiac,
exactly.
I think I could keep them sold on Connecticut. I'd like to take that chance.
Right. And so I just think that, you know, you think of the reputation of some of our private colleges and our public colleges and just Connecticut as the place for higher education. I think Massachusetts and Connecticut, maybe you have to throw in California, but, you know, those would be places that people think of as the place. So, again, I think we should think about how can we look ahead and think about how some sort of higher ed collaborative in the state could be an economic driver in multiple ways, bringing in money for our colleges and universities, but also, I mean, our private colleges and public colleges are doing this now. They're going overseas to recruit students now. They see this. They know it's coming. So how, as we do our plan, can we take that international demand into account and leverage our private and public colleges and the capacity you've developed before other places? So I just, this has been like such a, I think, such a wonderful conversation, and you are such a wealth of information. We have to build on that.
And appreciate it. It's fun to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. Appreciate it.
I actually just want to give a pitch and a compliment, really, to Ed, because when you were talking about doing the international and working as a partnership, the reality is Ed sort of very quickly glossed over, oh, in the early days we had some money and we gave it out. The reality is in the early days when the Distance Learning Consortium began, which is public and private institutions, what we as a state said was, this is expensive. We don't really know how to do, you know, we, higher ed, we don't know what we're doing. Let's get a place to do it, and let's give support to institutions across the state, all institutions across the state, to figure out how you do something online. Let's put the tools in their hand, and then we put some money into it, actually. And it was, in the scheme of things, it was a little amount of money per institution. But as a consortium, we said the first thing we want to do is to make sure that there's a single degree up online, and we don't care who gives the classes. You know, we don't care where they're from. As long as a student can go and say, I'm going to get a degree in general studies or something. And we then gave grants out to institutions who filled those courses in here in this state. And then we went from the single courses to full degrees. And it was very intentional. It was very strategic. And it was, again, not a lot of money, but that was the way it was. And so when you were talking about, there's a structure in place and there's a history in place to do that. And we did it really well. Thanks to Ed.
Oh, but Jason.
Go ahead. I'm just ignoring this whole side of the room. That's all right. First of all, I try not to heap too much praise onto Ed, having worked for him for a number of years.
Please, we won't be able to let. Yeah, I know.
At Charter Oak State College.
He wants to teach two classes next month.
I have both of my degrees from the 19th greatest public institution and public university in the world, whatever the rankings are, and. You know, when I first started working at Charter Oak, I was born and raised in New Britain. I was on the city council in New Britain at the time, and somebody had said, oh, well, you should apply for this job at Charter Oak State College. Oh, where is it? New Britain. Okay. This is, you know, it truly was one of the gems that you don't...
Don't call it a best-kept secret.
I didn't say it was a bad... I didn't say the word best-kept secret. But, you know, having worked there for a number of years for Merle Harris, and then later for Ed. I think we've seen the evolution of this distance learning. To me, I think as we kind of wrap this up and figure out how does this play into the plan that we are going to be coming up with, I think the slide that surprised me the most was probably the one in which you described the allocations of students with different percentages in terms of where they help if you had a. There you go, page 8. And I think that's important for us moving forward with this because it really, and you had said something very important, Ed, what do you think of, you know, when you think of college? You know, when I think of college, I think of, beautiful fall day in Storrs, Connecticut, walking back and forth from my dorm to the CAF, to my classes, to the library where I spent all of my time in the library, never any time away from the library, all my time in the library. But, that was my experience, and we all fall back upon, visually, at least what our own experiences in college are. I think the point that you made earlier and the thing that we need to carry with us as we continue in this endeavor is that that's not college for everybody. And things have changed. And in terms of how things will change in the future, you alluded to the fact before that I do not have college-age children, thank God. I do not. But I do have 5 kids in elementary school. And it is, if I apply the same logic that I used about college, I think of elementary school, I think of my kindergarten teacher sitting there in the middle of a circle, reading a book, and we'd go around, we'd pass blocks and stuff like that. I go into my kids' classes. That's not what they have nowadays. There's these Promethean boards, and my fifth grader came home with a Nook the other day that the teacher loads all of their reading onto. So as change continues to permeate through the ages, it's only going to increase as time goes on. So in terms of what we put together, I think that's what we've got to, I think that's what we need to keep in mind is that this isn't what we all have in our minds in terms of what college used to be. It is different.
One of the most impressive numbers in those slides is the same one that, on page 8. That shows that students who are older than 24 years of age, that's 65% of the total population. Now, I find this remarkable. It's not surprising to me because I've dealt with these numbers before, but it's remarkable, and that is where you must take Charter Oak and other institutions like you. That is where you must take pride and credit, because what it means is that folks that are now adults into the employment community and so on are getting better educated and more skills and so on, and I think that is where your place is primarily. Addressing the other number, the 18 to 24, that is when adolescents become men and women, basically. That's 35%, and that's just fine. And in that area, in that category of students, there is a bit that you cannot do. I asked you before, what's the downside? And I got some answers, but let me answer my question now.
You're right. It's a coming-of-age piece.
Coming-of-age. And I will describe this with a very timely example, personal example. Before I came to the meeting today, I had 5 emails from students in one of my courses, and it took me a couple of hours to answer them all, because I promised them that my top priority to answer to do is top priority among the things I have to do is to answer their emails. Now, those students are in my class. We meet 3 times a week. Their questions were some dealing with difficulties, some actually expanding beyond the discussion. The point is that their questions arose because of what I did with them in class. Not because they heard me on an online course, but what I did in person, in class, that's what gave rise to those questions. And being able to use information technology tools like email, etc., simply extends the number of hours I spend with them beyond the classroom and beyond the office hours. It's additional hours that they had the benefit of consulting with me in addition to class hours and office hours. I'm not so sure, and I hope that what I've done with them basically promoted their understanding, their skills, their critical thinking, and will be doing this the entire semester, the entire year. I'm not so sure that simply the model of online delivery of courses can do that sort of thing. And this is what I think we have to take into account. What it can be done and what it cannot be done. I don't think it can do what I did this morning.
My question actually has to do with more of a comment, but I'd like to hear you respond to it. It was very hard working on the transfer and articulation piece with our state colleges. We're still not over them because of the hesitation of the academic community within themselves arguing about who, what school will take what from who. And some of the hearings we had on it were eye-openers. So if it's that hard to get the academic community to move on transfer and articulation, how hard is it going to be, how difficult is it going to be for them to embrace this kind of a change?
I don't have an answer. All I can tell you is what's happened in other industries. And you know these stories as well as I do. Some industries, some companies resisted, insisted that their way of doing business would survive. In some cases it did, and in some cases it didn't. So do you want to take the risk that the world will never make you change and you can continue to do what you do forever because it's wonderful? Or not? I mean, it's somebody's going to have to make those choices. Now, those will be institutional choices, departmental choices. People make career choices. That's the nature of economy that includes destruction. I mean, I'm reading Why Nations Fail, and the line in it is continually about the ability to destroy and rebuild. Higher ed is not exempt from creative destruction. No one is. If you stop that process, what you have is sort of a totalitarian economy that can't evolve. So all I'm telling you is I don't know the answer to that question, but I know where I want to bet my career. I want to be in the arena of creative destruction. I want to take advantage of new opportunities. I think it's better to try to build than it is to defend. At the end of the day, if consumers are really going to make choices that impact our industry, and we are a very protected industry, you're part of what protects us. But even that protection didn't protect those other industries that got disrupted. So all I'm saying is I think you need to find, as a planning group, you need to find a way to invest in the future. I think Chris said it best. I mean, we have bond money for buildings. We have people money for folks. Do we have a pool of dollars to support innovation, real innovation? Even the kinds of innovations that threaten those same things that we're funding buildings and people for. Because that's the nature of real disruptive innovation. It does threaten the things that exist today. It's scary stuff. It scares me too. How'd I do?
Did okay. Now
thank
I
you.
Have a follow-up. How do you do sports? Where's your team?
Charter Oak's got NFL players on the roster. We kick
you?
Butt.
Do you do wee bowling or something? Is that what you...
It's fantasy.
No.
Fantasy
I'm not even going
football.
There. You win.
Okay. On that note, I will pass the microphone to the chair.
A most provocative discussion. Thank you, Ed. I didn't even get to talk to you about faculty development, which is sort of the issue that I think is of absolute imperative for us as we look at it. But what I can, after listening, to observe is that clearly distance learning must be part of our strategic plan. How it is, in as you said, woven into, I don't think it's a system unto itself, nor should it be. But how we make that part of going forward and how we create a more collaborative community of learning. And, Bagos, I hope you are both right and wrong. I still believe that there is value in, and I think Ed said it too, the hybrid model has value of there's something on ground that cannot be done online. But I would bet you dimes to donuts that good faculty who have the ability and the expertise to teach online create some of those same questions. I have to think that that's true. So with that prerogative of the closed comment, let me just mention that our next meeting is October 8th. We will be here. Hopefully, keep your fingers crossed that our new consultants, NCHEMS, will be here to join us, and that will be our focus in terms of going forward there. And if there's any other business, please, now is the time to raise your hand. Yes, madam.
Well, it's just a suggestion as we go forward to think about a future agenda item. It seems to me that, like, the conversation today was great because it was a combination of faculty, online, public, private. It feels to me that this is such a critical issue where Connecticut could distinguish itself that it could be worth us thinking about a longer discussion someday when we have a lot we have more critical players in the room from more institutions to talk about what we're doing now, but where we're going. Because all these colleges, private and public, are looking out. They have people looking out. And so I just think it's going to be really important that we have this conversation with more people in a facilitated way, maybe with our planners, that because at least it feels like such an opportunity for collaboration of our higher ed marketplace.
I would totally agree. I think our hope and prayer for this going forward is involvement of lots of stakeholders. I mean, the issue is we need to identify, a larger community that needs to be part of this discussion, and we need to have more robust discussions. I think this is not something we need to do to people. We need to do it with each other, for each other, and it needs to be something that we can create buy-in. And again, our hope is that the consultant, having done this in many states, will be very helpful in creating that commitment. So, all right, one last question. Yes, Jude.
One comment. So I think that you're quite right that colleges are looking and thinking about this all the time. And so I'll just tell you a conversation. I support a council of engineering deans. It's public and private. And they're talking about, I think they were calling it a ROOC, a regional online, open online course that in engineering. So, and it was, deans from UConn, Hartford, New Haven, it was a whole bunch of deans sort of saying, let's think this through. So, I mean, every institution is thinking about it in different ways, but, that's exactly what you were talking about.